Hey everyone, welcome back to The Screenwriting Life. I'm Lorianne McKenna. Meg is not joining us today because she's out of town, but we are really excited to talk to writer and director Cora Jefferson, whose movie American Fiction is out right now. But before we do that, we're going to do Adventures in Screenwriting Life with me and Jeff. So this week I have a deadline. I have a script due in a couple of days, so I'm working on that. And I'm working on an adaptation, so I'm working on that. I have a TV show I'm going to run, hopefully. And I'm getting ready to prepare a pitch that I'm going to take out that was, we didn't get to take out because of the strike. So I'm really excited about that. And I love the show and I can't wait for it to be on the air. So my strategy around the show I'm taking out is that I am hoping to meet someone who loves it as much as I do. I'm not trying to sell it. I just want to find somebody who wants to make it as much as I do. So that frame of mind is helping me. That's what I'm looking for. So when I go into pitches and meetings, I'm going to be like, yeah, you love it as much as I do. Let's do it. And if they don't, then okay, they're not the right person for the project. So I will find that. And then I will keep everybody up to date on my journey with this project as we go forward. The other thing that I sort of encountered and was really interested in as it relates to screenwriting, I found this book I really love, and it's very popular, and it's a whole series, and you know, it's out there. I think somebody has the TV rights already, and they're going to turn it into a TV show. But I looked at this writer's all the work she's done, and she's written a lot, and so I thought, oh, I'll go read some other things she's written, and it's all genre, which I love. And as I'm reading the books that she's written before this, I can see where she's improving. I can see how she built up her craft and her skills to get where she is with this book that everybody loves and is making a TV show. But what I really admire about her is that her first couple of books, I can see who she is in those books, and I can see her developing the craft and leaning into the genre, and they're okay. And I enjoy them, but they're not as well done as the other ones. And there's so many of them. And what I love about this, and it's such a good reminder, is you make a thing. It's not quite, I don't think she wanted it to be that she wanted it to be the version that came out 9 years later that everybody loves. She still put it out there. And then she wrote the next one and she put that one out there. And every single book she writes, she's getting better and better at craft, surprising the audience, the character work, everything. And I want to remind us all that that's how we should be approaching our scripts. The expectation that the script we write is going to be the one that is the most popular, is the best, is the one that blows the socks off everyone is not realistic. We get to write a script and finish it and be done and share it. And then in 10 years, we get to look back at our earlier work and be like, wow, I've really improved. Not 10 years later, looking at the same script. So you got to keep writing and finishing and trusting that as you're doing that, you're getting better and you're developing your craft and your skills and your taste and your knowledge and everything. And also I can look at this writer's work like that because I don't want to be a novelist. I think it's incredibly hard. I have no interest in doing it. And so I can look at it with kindness and love without judgment. Oh, wow, look, she's getting better. Right? Rather than when I look at my own work, which is, wow, I still suck at that thing. Instead of that, I'm going to just finish the thing and keep going because I have a lot of stories in me, a lot of them, because genre follows the same format. So all of these stories are the same format, very similar. And yet she does something new and different with every single one. So that was my sort of jolt of reality in terms of you got to finish and put something out there and walk away. And go on to the next many, many things.
It's really valuable, Lorianne. We talked about it on the show. Meg and I both read this book last year called Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, which is by this author, Gabrielle Zevin, who I think it's her ninth novel. And it's so funny because, of course, all the reviews are like her breakout book. And she's like, I've been writing books for 20 years. But she said, and this was a huge bestseller, super acclaimed, but she said that this is the first book she's written where she feels like her ambition and her taste finally matched the book. So I just think it's so important what you're saying, but that doesn't mean her preceding eight novels aren't great for what they are. And some of them are beloved, but she's like, it took me eight books to feel like I could finally write the book that I was able to like really match my taste and my craft with the ambition of the story I wanted to tell. So that should be affirming to all of us.
And that's what I see. I see her in all these books. I saw her working out things that I saw in the series that is really popular and everybody loves. Like I could, oh, this is that same moment in that one. She's like working this out. Like, oh, this is that scene here. And this, like, I can see her rough, but they're not rough drafts. They're just, she's just
polishing,
dialing it in this really beautiful way. I don't know. I'm not going to call her out.
The other thing I like, the other thing I like about what you're saying though, Lorian, is that I think you mentioned that you could see her even in her early work that wasn't quite as polished. So what I'm also hearing you say is even if your craft and your taste isn't quite to the level of ambition that you hope it'll be in a decade, you still have to be in the work because that's going to be the thing that pushes it as you continue to hone your craft.
Yeah. Yeah. So how was your week, Jeff?
It was interesting. I mentioned it a couple weeks ago, but I've been having a lot of fun. I'm writing like a very kind of traditionally paced medical network drama, which I hope isn't a stupid follow-up to this like earnest indie coming of age dramedy I released last year, but I'm having a lot of fun and it's nice because there's like an engine and like I feel like I've pitched it to some folks and they can start throwing me episode ideas. So I'm like, okay, there's a framework here that I feel like is like the good sort of DNA for a show. And I've been having a lot of fun. I'm like doing research on like in the, it's, you know, most medical dramas, there's like a couple cases of the week in the A story and the B story. So I'm like researching this specific case and like learning about the different ways that it could go wrong in the operating room and like what this team of doctors could do to adjust. And I'm kind of having a blast, but it's very strange for me because up until now, most of my writing has been sort of grounded down to earth character stuff. And network TV is weird, especially medical TV, because by nature of what it is, it's just kind of elevated. Like the dialogue that the doctors are throwing around in the OR and the ER probably wouldn't exactly mirror how people would actually talk in that room. So I'm having to check myself, like, is this like canned, like hack writing, or is this just like matching the beats and the pacing of like an exciting 42-minute act broken network show? So it's been interesting to like check myself on that. Like this still feels true, even if the dialogue is existing in this kind of like elevated, heightened world, just because I don't have a ton of experience writing in that tone. So
you've
it's been
seen
kind
all
of
those shows,
right?
And you have
exactly.
to have fun. Like what you have.
It is
fun
really
with.
Fun. I'm having a blast.
Like, do you think Aaron Sorkin was like, I wonder if they really talk like this in the White House?
That's true. No, that's exactly right. But it is a funny thing of like checking as you're pushing into style and like elevated dialogue or whatever, you have to keep asking yourself, like, is this true? Like, does this still reflect the truth of what the show's about?
So you have like Jodie Foster sitting here on your shoulder.
Yeah, exactly.
True.
And then Shonda Rhimes over here, right? Like, because right. I mean, she's probably the most celebrated writer in town, but her characters kind of have that elevated thing going on in her stuff too. So it's been really fun. It's just been like pushing me and I'm letting it just be fun. Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. And Savannah, how was your week?
Oh, it was great. But I did have a question for you guys, because you're talking about like kind of falling in love with IP and, you know, like different writers and not really, and also Cord, you know,
We can let him know. We pre-taped our segment with Cord. So if you want to throw to something he'll mention, you can.
Falling in love with book, not knowing if the rights are there.
Yeah.
I was curious, like, what your thoughts are about, like, if you do fall in love with a piece of material and you are an emerging writer, like, is there some, and you, like, see yourself in it and you feel it in your bones, the way Cord will explain, is there some wisdom into just kind of, like, pursuing that as a writing exercise? Or is it a fool's errand? I'm just curious what you guys think.
I wouldn't do it. Because I feel like your time, all that energy, all that connection to that can be spent developing your own material or finding a different piece of IP. I don't think any writing is wasted. I think probably some writers have done this as an exercise. It's like a spec script of an existing show. It's an exercise. But when you're doing a spec script of an existing show, it's to learn format to write in someone else's voice. When you're adapting a book or an IP, it's to put your voice, to put yourself into that story. So I don't know if there's a reader for it. That's the thing, right? We write to be written ultimately. I don't know. I wouldn't do it. I would go through the whole grieving process about it. Oh, the rights are already taken. Clearly, I wasn't the person to write this. Now, I will say the book that I adapted, the rights were held by somebody else. I was commissioned to write it. Then the rights were available, and then I got them and I rewrote my script. So sometimes you just got to watch it. That's what I would recommend. Pay attention. Who has the rights? What are they doing with it? But I wouldn't. Would you?
I don't have an answer for this because I have never adapted anything.
Well, yeah, like I mean, I've reached out to a publisher before for, like a young adult novelist who I thought was really promising, and just got a response saying, yeah, the rights are available, period, no further session. But and kind of took it, with you kind of like pitched it out or started an outline, but I mean that's one approach, I guess, maybe to see.
Well, so when you're getting rights for project, you want to make sure that you don't ask them too many times or from too many places, because then they might think, oh, a lot of people are interested. And it's good to go through a rep or a producer, right? Well, you're a producer, so right, you would be doing it. But get the rights, then work on it.
Well, speaking of rights, that's a great transition into our conversation with Cord. Lauren, do you want to introduce our amazing guest, Cord Jefferson?
Yes, I do. Today, we're thrilled to welcome Cord Jefferson, whose debut feature film, American Fiction, which he wrote and directed, is one of the most talked about movies of the year. Cord has experience as a journalist, having written for publications including Gawker, USA Today, and The Root, and has written for TV shows Master of None, The Good Place, Watchmen, and Succession. Welcome, Cord. We're super excited to have you on the show today. And we actually met in an elevator at AFF.
Oh, really? Oh, wait a minute. Yes, you were at the hotel. Yes,
Yes,
yes.
yeah,
Good
for
to
like
see you
5 seconds.
again.
It was
Yes,
like
I do remember this. I remember that. Good to see you again.
number one, how are you?
I'm doing well. I'm doing well. I
Well,
cannot complain. I cannot complain. It's these are crazy days, but it's preferable to the alternative. So I will accept the craziness.
what's the alternative?
I think that the releasing I was listening to this. I'm a big John Waters fan, and I was listening to this John Waters interview they were doing because they did the retrospective at the Academy Museum, and somebody came up to him and they said, "What do you, what's your advice for sort of like budding filmmakers? Like, what do you need to do to be a filmmaker?" And I can't remember exactly what he said, but his last word of advice was, "Somebody has to like it besides your mama and the person you're fucking."
I mean, it's true.
I think that the alternative is putting your heart and soul into this thing, as so many people do, and then sort of, it just coming out and nobody paying attention to it. And I think that especially in this world when it's so hard to break through because people, you're not just competing with all the other television shows and movies, you're competing with TikTok and the internet, and just sort of like people are just sort of like people's attention is just all these other places other than where it used to be, which is on film and television, that it's really hard to break through. And it's really sort of, I've worked on stuff that I'm really proud of that people don't pay attention to. And I just think that there is, so I think that I especially when it's something as this movie is so deeply personal to me, and there's so much of me in it that, I'm very, and also it was, we made it with almost no money. It was sort of like very, we made it in almost no time. It was just sort of like very, very sort of like, it was a very sort of, it was a thing where I was just like, I love this. I think this is good, but I have no idea if anybody else is going to think this is good, And so the momentum that it's gotten and the attention it's received is beyond my wildest dreams. And so I think that that's the thing. It's just, you're making anything as a vulnerable experience, I think, especially when you're, like I said, is something as personal as this is to me.
So I'd love to hear about, so I love the movie. I thought it
Thank
was
you.
poignant and funny and heartbreaking and challenging. and so well written and so
Thank
well
you.
Directed. And the performances were stunning. I mean,
Thanks.
Really, truly, how those actors made those characters come alive. But it's so much to speaks to like the specificity that you wrote those characters.
Yeah.
And so it was like a gift for me
Thank
to be
you.
Like, because we on the show, we always talk about specificity creates relatability. And
yeah.
This is a world I know nothing about. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I was in academia for a hot second. So I know
yeah.
it, like just the book world and everything else, the story you were telling. But I felt so connected to the characters because of that specificity.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I was deeply in love with Cliff. I don't know why
me
like, I
too.
Love all the characters, but like Cliff for me was like, oh man, I want to spend time with that guy
yeah,
just to
exactly.
see what he'll do and he'll say. And that sort of kind of risky character.
Yeah.
And that sort of like, oh my God, he's so unexpected.
Yeah.
He must have been so fun to write.
Oh God. Yeah. I think that, you know, the two characters who resemble me the most are Monk and Cliff. And
oh my God, that's such a weird dichotomy.
I know. I know. But I think that it's because I feel very much I think that one of the themes of the film is what happens to people when they don't feel free to be who they are, and sort of like, and the weird things that people will do when they feel like they're not given the freedom to be who they want to be. And I think that it's sort of like, it's these, what you're seeing is these, you know, what you're seeing in Cliff is like a guy who's finally saying like, I want to be who I am. And like going through this sort of like rocky road to finding who that is, but it's like, he's doing it. He's saying like, I'm sick of living secretly. I'm sick of not being who I actually am. And I want to sort of like be open with that. And so he's on a sort of like rough road to get there, but he's getting there, you know, he's sort of like, he's trying. And Monk is a guy who can't do that. A Monk is a guy who sort of like has built up this facade. He's sort of like, he's not really letting anybody in. He's alienated his family. He's alienated his colleagues. He's alienated his love interests. He's just sort of like very much created and turned himself into an island and sort of like lives behind this veneer and doesn't really let anybody in. And so for a long, long time, that was me. I think that that was a guy, that was who I was. I was a guy who really didn't let anybody in. There was, you know, I was alienated from my family. I was alienated from my friends. I was a guy, I remember I had a friend one time, a new friend. I was just meeting this person. And at the end of our dinner, he said to me, I realized that we've just spoken for 2 hours and you know everything about me and I know nothing about you. And that was sort of like the kind of person that I was sort of like, I really didn't let anybody in, was very interested in other people and chatty and sort of like nice and friendly, but like, I didn't like to answer questions about myself. I didn't really like to get deep about myself. It was just, that is something that sort of like, I kept at a distance. And so it's sort of, I feel very much like Cliff now because I am trying to explore that and become that. And it has been kind of a rocky road as I've sort of like tried to figure out who that is. But for a long time I was Monk. And I just think that people, we all build up facades, you know, and I think that and we all sort of like have things that are secret to us that we do not let other people see. And I think that, you know, a lot of this movie was cathartic for me in writing about these characters who are trying to get past that and who are trying to be more open with the world, you know.
So you've been a writer, you've been a journalist and a TV writer and now a feature film writer and director.
Yeah.
When in your career did you have that dinner with a friend when you realized that? What were you writing at that time? And part two of that is, when did you get your hands on this book?
Yeah.
Percival Everett.
So I was a journalist when that person said that. And there was and sort of like there was all these clues in my life that I wasn't really paying attention to. Because around that same time, I had a girlfriend who said to me, it's so weird to me because you write about the most intimate details of your life and you publish it for the whole world to read. And she said, and then when we talk, you don't tell me anything. Like she said, I learn about you through your writing. I learn things about you that you've never told me. And I'm one of the closest people in the world to you. And I think that sort of like at the time, I still was really blind to what she was saying and what was going on in the world, which was that writing for me, like, I think one of the reasons why I always was drawn to writing, even before I allowed myself to think of myself as a writer, is because it always felt cathartic for me. It always felt like the first time that I really started writing things for the public consumption, I was on my high school newspaper. And I decided to join the high school paper and I became an op-ed columnist. And I remember, you know, it's whatever your op-eds are when you're a teenager, but I remember thinking like, there's something that feels really good about this. This feels nice. It feels good to sort of like write my thoughts down and sort of like organize them and then put them out there. There's something nice about that. And I don't think I ever connected that, like, the reason I loved writing is because I was allowing myself to be honest with people. And I was actually sort of like telling people the truth. And I was sort of saying things that I felt uncomfortable saying to people in my actual life, you know? And
but
so I
still
think
a little
that,
bit of protecting, right? Still a little
oh,
bit of difference
oh,
because you
absolutely,
can
because
hide behind a persona.
Oh,
Right.
absolutely.
But so
Absolutely.
then, you know,
absolutely. And so
yes.
that to me was what I think that when I really started getting good at writing was when I was like, okay, let's start to be a little bit more honest and let's start to be vulnerable. And like when the writing feels vulnerable, that's when I think you're really onto something. And so I had been, this came to me after I had had a, we all had a really awful 2020. I don't think that that's saying anything unique, but in 2020, besides the pandemic, I had had this huge professional failure where I thought I had come so close to getting a TV show made that people had started telling me the address of where our production offices were going to be in New York to tell me to start getting my Airbnb near here because here's where the production offices are going to be. And it was like, great, okay, this is on rails, we're good. And then, you know, as it so happens so often in this industry, it was like at the last minute, they were like, actually, we're not doing this anymore. And it's dead. And so that was September of 2020. And I was really.
And you're just left there with all those characters.
We'd written it. Well,
dead
not we'd
around you.
We'd written the entire season by then. The entire season was written.
Oh,
all,
no.
all the episodes were written. We had done all the work. The show was written. And it was just like, sorry, we're not doing this anymore. And so I was really feeling really creatively adrift. I was feeling really miserable. And I was looking for just a new book to read over the holiday break. I was with no designs on finding something to adapt. It was just like, let's find something to read for the next week and a half. And so I was reading this review for a different book. And in the review, it referenced Erasure. And I had never heard of Erasure. And I went and picked it up and kind of, I'm a very slow reader normally. But this was just something that I just devoured. It was like, kind of like, oh, I just, when I was away from it, I was like, I need to go back to that book. I need to go back to that book and see what happens. And so I read it in about a week, which is really fast for me. And within 100 pages, I kind of knew I want to adapt this into a screenplay. And then, you know, I started reading the novel in Jeffrey Wright's voice. I started picturing Jeffrey in the scenes as Monk.
Wow.
It just started to sort of manifest before my eyes. Like I need to make this happen. And so as soon as I was done with it, I reached out to my manager and said, I think you should read this book because I think that I might want to try to make this into a movie. And so he read it really quickly. And then we reached out to Percival Everett, the author for the rights, and it went from there.
Wow. So you were about 100 pages in.
Yeah.
But what was it? What was that feeling? Right. We talk a lot about this on the show too. Like, I've adapted a book before and I got about 30 pages in and I was like, this is me. I'm the only one that can tell her story.
Yes.
Right. Like, it's me.
Exactly.
It's just in a wish fulfillment version of me.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And so it also felt like I felt it in my body. Right.
Yeah.
I felt jumpy and excited about it. Like, I got to do this right now. I got to make this happen.
You're describing me exactly in that, like, I read it over the holidays. And the thing that I was so frustrated about was that it was the holidays. So everything was closed. And I was like, well, we got to do this now. Like, I want to get it on the phone. Like, get into your office. Like, Hollywood needs to open again. And it was like, sorry, you got to wait until like the new year. And so it was like, I feel the same way. I was like bouncing off the walls, ready to sort of like start working on this. And it was like, and I was freaking out because I was like, what if the rights are taken? What if somebody else is already working on this? And like, I was having all these like terrifying ideas in my head that like this thing that I had just fallen in love with, I had to wait 2 weeks to find out that I couldn't do it. And it was sort of heartbreaking. You know, it's like being a kid and waiting for Christmas. That's truly what it felt like. And so, Fortunately, the rights were available, but the thing that I felt is exactly what you're describing. It was like, so there's obviously there's these satirical sort of professional themes in it about like what people expect of Black writers and sort of like the limitations and restrictions people put on what they think you can and can't write and what audiences want from you. And that sort of stuff was stuff that I'd been thinking about since I was a journalist. I was a journalist before I started working in film and television for 8 or 9 years. And that's stuff that I'd been talking about since I was a journalist, this idea that people really had a limited perspective as what journalists of color should write about, what we could write about. And then when I got into film and television, I realized it was more the same. It was like, do you want to write about slavery? Do you want to write about drug dealers? Do you want to write about, single mothers, like it's struggling to get their kids out of foster care? Like it's just all these sort of, we understand the sort of the tropes of what it means to like make Black cinema and Black TV. And so to me, the that stuff really stood out to me immediately. But then on top of that, it was like, I have two siblings, the way that Monk has two siblings. We have our own push and pull dynamic, the way that Monk has with his siblings, where sometimes we're closer, but sometimes we're more distant. We have a very overbearing father figure. I love my father very much, but he has told me he is willing to be called overbearing. He's admitted that he was overbearing. And that was his relationship with us, like Monk and his family had. My mother didn't die of Alzheimer's, but my mother died of cancer 8 years ago. And like Monk, I moved home for a period of time to take care of her toward the end of her life. So as you said, it was like, I was like, it started to get like the Venn diagram between Monk's life and my life started to become a circle where I was just like, this, I understand this person and these characters on a molecular level. Like I just really feel like I knew them in my bones. And so that's what I was like, I need to adapt this just because I feel like I know this story and these characters as well, if not better than any writer on earth. Like that this feels like I just understood. Like I think that that's the key to a great adaptation, right? And not making something that's, I think some people just are like, well, why are you adapting this book? It's like, well, it was because of a very popular book. And so it's a very, and so it could be a very popular movie because it's a very popular book. And I think that those adaptations tend to be pretty bloodless sometimes and feel like you can feel that there is no passion in them. And so I think the adaptations that really sing for me have always been ones where you can tell like somebody saw themselves in this really deeply and like, this is me. And I sort of like that there's something really personal here for me that I want to touch on. And that's how I felt. I felt the exact same way as you felt. Truly, like down to feeling jumpy. Like I remember feeling jumpy the way that you felt jumpy.
And it's scary though too, right? Because you're willingly saying, I'm going to take the responsibility of this story, and you're going to trust me with it. And so then where do you start? So you got the rights to the book. You're sitting down. It's day one. What are you doing?
Just from a practical level, the thing that I tell people is I very fortunately have this wonderful assistant named Hannah Offer, who sort of
A
was the first.
one, get an assistant. Got it.
Yes. Yes. But if you don't have, but the thing that I asked Hannah to do was I was like, just go through and outline the novel for me in prose. I want just sort of like a rough, like basically sort of like condense the book into 10 pages and sort of like the big beats and sort of like the big things that happen. And so, yeah, I didn't want to, I was going to say that I outlined it and I was like, you can't erase the fact that you had somebody do this
Well
for
done,
you. And
Hannah.
so, yeah, Hannah Offer is amazing. She's become a really close friend of mine besides just sort of like a colleague, but, that was the first thing that I did. I think the first key is just put everything on paper as you go through and sort of like read the book again and go put everything on paper that exists in the story. And then once you have that in front of you, then it allows you to say like, okay, here's what I can omit. Here's what I don't need. Like here's what happens in the book, but I don't need in the film. And sort of like what's gonna make there's things that I think are like essential to the spirit and the essence of the novel that you don't want to lose because you don't want to lose people who loved the novel. You don't want to make some, and you also want Percival asked to read the script before he would give me the rights. So he gave me the rights to the book for free for 6 months. He said, go off and write a script. And if something comes of it, then you can pay me then. But before then, he's like, just go off and write the script. But so before he would officially give me the rights, he had to read the script. And so
Wow.
it's like, so I had to make sure that I was doing something that felt like I could show it to the author and say, look, I understand what you were attempting to do while also making something that was different from the book and was more cinematic and was a movie that they would let me write, you know? And so it was just about figuring, okay, this is like a good funny part of the book, but I don't need this for the film. And this is a good part of the book, but it's not cinematic enough. And so like, let's get rid of this. And so it was just sort of like cutting and moving around pieces. It's like building the puzzle, right? It's like kind of like cutting out this and then sort of like cutting this out and moving this out because this is better here in a movie. And like, this is wonderful, but we have to excise this. It was just about sort of like putting that together. And once was able to put that together, that was sort of my outline. And then I just went from there. And it was like, then when I had those in place, I was like, okay, now that I have the stuff in place from the book, what's missing? What do I need to add? Like, what do I need to sort of like put in that's not here? And so, for instance, that scene with Issa and Jeffrey at the end of the film, where they're sort of talking about their different approaches to art and sort of their different approaches to writing, that's not in the book. But when I was reading the book and looking at the outline, I was like, I was really craving that scene. I was like, I can't wait for Monk and Centaur to meet because that's going to be an explosive, really fun, meaty scene where they talk about their different perspectives. And that wasn't in the book. And so I was like, okay, I need to add that. That's something that I need to add. And then I need to add this. And then I need to add this. And then once I had that, then I had my outline and then I was ready to write. And it's sort of like that made, just from a practical standpoint, that was the process, was just picking and choosing what you need and what you don't need, and then figuring out what you need to add that didn't exist in the original text to make it something that you also need to acknowledge that, you know, you're going to make some big changes, you know, and that's okay. I think that one of the things that I learned about adaptation in Watchmen was the first adaptation that I ever worked on. And the thing that Damon kept saying in the room was, every writer understands this feeling, right? Which is that looking at a blank page is both equally exciting and terrifying. It's exciting because you're like, you can do anything, but then
It's
it's
Monk
terrifying.
and Cliff.
Yeah,
It's Monk and Cliff.
exactly. But then it's terrifying because you're like, you can do anything. And so there's no restrictions there. And that can be paralyzing because like, I can do whatever. And so now I don't even know where to begin because I can do whatever. And so the parameters that Damon put on Watchmen, because he was like, we can do anything, was, we can do whatever we want because we're building a brand new world, but it needs to feel Watchmen. He always said that. Like, it needs, we all understand the feeling that this book gives us, and we need to hew to the feeling, not necessarily the text, but we need to hew to the emotions and the spirit and the essence. And so he would say, you'd have a pitch sometimes, he's like, that's a good pitch for something else, but it doesn't feel Watchmen. And so to me, that was what I needed to hew closely to, was like, what feels like Erasure? Does this feel like the novel? Does this feel like it's of a piece with everything else that exists there? And that was really a guiding principle too when I started writing. It was like, does this feel like, so for instance, it needed to be funny. I knew that because the book is very funny.
I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt you. The
No,
joke
please.
with Monk and his sister in the car slayed me. I don't want
That's
to give
from
it
the
away.
book. That's from the book. I will
I
not
don't want
take
to give it
credit for
away
that.
in case
I will
people
not
haven't
take
seen it
credit for
yet.
that.
Like, no
That is from
spoilers,
the
but
book. I'm
I was still laughing when I was driving home. I
happy to
just,
hear that.
I, because it was so well delivered and so
Yeah.
well directed, and it
Yeah,
was
she's
so
amazing.
earnest. Like, the question was so earnest. You know, it was like, oh, this isn't a joke setup vibe,
Yeah.
but it, oh, so good.
I'm happy
So
to hear
good.
that. No, I
Anyway.
love that joke. It's amazing. It's it yeah, well, let's spoil it, but
Okay.
it's a long walk, but it's
Oh,
good. It's got
it
a good
was
payoff.
delicious. It was
Thank
delicious. Okay,
you.
so
Yeah.
it had to be funny to
But it had
feel
to be
like the book.
funny. It had to be a little meta-textual because the book is a little meta. And so I needed to incorporate some of those elements. And then one of the last things, the epilogue of the book is this Latin phrase that I was unfamiliar with, but apparently it's normally used in relationship to complex mathematics. And the rough translation is, I offer no hypothesis. That's sort of like the last words of that novel are, I offer
I
no
get the ending
hypothesis.
now.
Yeah. And so to me, I couldn't make a movie that felt didactic. I couldn't write something that felt like it was spoon feeding you morality. It needed to be like, here's some characters, here's some scenarios, and it's up to you to decide how you feel when you walk out of this thing, when you're done consuming it. And so those were like three pillars that I was like, I need to make sure that I include this stuff. And the rest, I can kind of like add in what feels erasure, but sort of like isn't necessarily exactly what happened in the book. And so that was important to me also, was to maintain the spirit and the feeling and not necessarily maintain the text. And I think that those are all very, very important things to making an adaptation really work.
I agree. And I love what that you brought up that phrase at the end, because I was going to ask you, was there like a central image or something you were holding up as like the guidepost? And it seems like it was those three things. So
Yeah,
I think, and anything
exactly.
we write, I feel like we need to be focused on that so we understand for ourselves and can articulate the core of the project that we're working on.
Exactly, exactly.
Did you know you were going to direct from the beginning?
No. But by the time that I was done reading the novel, I felt like, okay, this is. I knew that when I went to write the script, I knew that I felt so passionately about the material. I knew that when I went to write the script, I would feel so. There's so much of me in the script, as I said, because I felt so close to the material. There's so much of me in it, literally, sort of like things that have happened in my life to the fake book titles. Most of those fake book titles are the names of my friends' bands in high school.
My God, I love
Like
it.
it was
I
just,
love it.
I just so when my friends' bands, someone when my friends from high school have gone to see the movie, they've like texted me immediately and they're like, "Oh my God, I can't believe it." So it's like Car Full of Bosnians was a punk band that a bunch of my Bosnian friends started in high school, and so I put that in there. So from big details to small details, there's a lot of me in there, and I knew that when I was done writing the script, I would feel so close to it that it would break my heart to give it away to somebody else. And I knew that I couldn't, I knew that I couldn't, I knew that it would break my heart if I sent it out and they were like, "This is great. Now let's see what Barry Jenkins is doing, or let's see what Spike Lee is doing." Like I knew that that would be too devastating of a development. Not that they couldn't direct it well. Like I love,
Yeah.
there's a lot of really great directors, but I just knew that I had a vision for it. And I knew that I really, really wanted to see that vision come to life. And so, by the time that I was done with the book, though, I felt like this script is going to be so important to me that it will break my heart if I let anybody else direct it. And so, when we took it out, I just said like it's a package deal, and if you have to read it knowing that I need to direct it, otherwise don't read it.
Wow. Yeah. The feature I adapted from this book, I've been having an ongoing conversation with myself about that same thing. I'm going to direct it.
Yeah.
I can't direct it. I want to
Yeah.
direct it. I can't direct it. Like, because
Yeah.
I
Have you ever
don't
directed something?
animation.
But the animation counts as directing, firstly, and secondly, like animation is cinema. We all need to
Oh,
understand it.
yes. I
Yeah,
mean,
and but
I
yeah,
come
but
from animation. I make
oh
animation.
yeah. Oh great. But secondly, like I think that actually I tell all writers who talk to me about directing that like you need to realize that maybe not everybody writes the way that I write, but when I'm writing, even before I started thinking about directing, when I was writing, I was already thinking about the way the characters are going to move around in this space, right? Where they're going to be standing in relation to each other. You're thinking about, have a rough idea of what they're wearing. You have a rough idea. You have an understanding of like how you want them to enunciate this line, right? Like how you want them to tell this joke, the energy that you want for this joke. You're already thinking about stuff that directors are thinking about. You're just not articulating it because you're like, well, I'm putting this on the page and then I hand it off to a director. And
Yeah.
so, but when you're in the creative process, you're already thinking about these things. And so to me, all you're doing, you're already kind of directing, right? Like there's more to it than these things, of course. Like there's personnel issues and sort of like HR stuff. Like there's like managerial stuff that is a different part of the creative process, I'll say. But like as far as sort of like the actual real straightforward creative process, you're already thinking like a director when you're making those decisions. You're just not telling anybody about them. So to me, I always tell people like, try it. Maybe you won't like it. Like I have, there's writers that I know who have tried directing and then they're like, never again. I did not enjoy that. I don't want to do it. I just want to write the script and that's fine for me. But I tell everybody just try it because you may love it. And sort of like, I actually think that directing makes you a much better writer. I think that it's helped my writing so much because I'm sitting there now looking at scenes and I'm like, I would cut this. Like as a director, if I were directing this scene right now, I would cut all of this because I don't need this. And sort of like, we need to move on to the next thing. And you just start thinking in those terms of like, what do you actually need for the scene? What's going to make the most interesting scene? And I think that when you're a writer, you become a writer because you love language and you love words and you love like what words can do and the power of language. And that is very, very important. But then you start to realize, like, yes, but I'm working in a visual medium. This isn't a novel. Like, and so sort of like, so as much as I love this line or this phrase, yeah, or sort of like, as much as I love this conversation, is it going to make the movie or the TV show better? Right.
Yeah. I've directed my own plays and I've had that. I've sat there and directed my play, like, out.
Exactly. And so I think
it feels good because you're like scraping away the marble, the whole thing where you're scraping it away.
Exactly.
I love this. I want to talk to you more about this. Like, we'll grab coffee.
I would love that. I would love to talk to you forever about it. This is, I love writing. I've loved writing since I started doing it, and talking to other writers is like one of my favorite things. So please, whenever.
Well, we have to go. We have to respect your time. I have one last question for you though, which is,
yes,
what is your favorite writing snack?
My favorite writing snack is, first LaCroix, sparkling water. I think
what every flavor? Writer... Please don't say lime.
No, I'm a pamplemousse guy.
Okay, same. Lime. I don't know what's wrong with all you lime drinkers out there.
It's too sweet. It's too sweet for me. I don't like it.
No.
The sort of like the synthetic lime is gross. And then, so a lot of sparkling water. And then I would probably say I really, really, really like the Trader Joe's dark chocolate covered almonds are sort of like that's
old
always
choice.
Sort of like, yeah, I really, okay, really, really love those. Why? What do most people say?
Well, I'm all chips and black licorice.
Oh, okay. Licorice. I mean, that's a very, my mother loved black licorice. That was a huge division in our household. Everybody else thinks that every time we went to the movies, she got Good and Plenty. And it was always annoying to me because, like, we couldn't share. I was like, I know you're not going to eat all those, and I hate them. Get something
that's
that we
both. That's why we cultivate a taste for this stuff. We don't have to share. No, I think dark chocolate covered almonds is such a good choice because you're not going to eat too many.
Yeah, exactly. It's like after lunch, it's always like, I also really like Mendocino Farms. I know Mendocino Farms is divisive, but I love Mendo. And always after lunch, I'll let myself eat like 6 dark chocolate covered almonds. Always.
Okay.
It's great.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Love this conversation, and thank you for coming on the show. And I would so love to have you come back.
I would love it.
Congratulations.
Anytime, thank you so
on
much.
On the Golden Globe nominations.
Thank you so much.
Hopefully all the other awards coming up soon. It's very exciting. Thank you so much.
No, thank you. It's been an honor. It's truly a pleasure. Thank you so much. Okay. Have a good one.
Thanks so much to Cord for being on today's show. And for more TSL support, check out our Facebook group where tons of people are finding support from both emerging and professional writers. And if you haven't done so, please go to Apple Podcasts and review us with a 5-star review. You don't have to write anything. I think you just click on the 5 stars. You can bounce. That's it. Or you can write something. We love to hear from you. Sometimes Jeff reads your reviews out loud. You get to be a little famous on our podcast. And finally, remember, you are not alone, and keep writing.